Chapter 5. Gardner Takes a Fall. 1. While Bobby Anderson was tracing a titanic shape with a compass and thinking the unthinkable with a brain more numbed with exhaustion than she knew, Jim Gardner was doing the only work he could these days. This time he was doing it in Boston. The poetry reading on June 25th was at BU. That went all right. The 26th was an off day. It was also the day that Gardner stumbled. Only, stumble didn't really describe what happened, unfortunately. It was no minor matter like snagging your foot under a root while you were walking in the woods. It was a fall that he took. One long fucking fall. Like taking a no-expenses-paid bone-smasher of a tumble down a long flight of stairs. Stairs? Shit, he had almost fallen off the face of the earth. The fall started in his hotel room. It ended on the breakwater at Arcadia Beach, New Hampshire, 8 days later. Bobby wanted to dig. Guard woke up on the morning of the 26th wanting to drink. He knew there was no such thing as a partially arrested alcoholic. You were either drinking or you weren't. He wasn't drinking now, and that was good. But there had always been long periods when he didn't even think about booze. Months, sometimes. He would drop into a meeting once in a while. If 2 weeks went by in which Guard didn't attend an AA meeting, he felt uneasy, the way he felt if he spilled salt and didn't toss some over his shoulder, and stand up and say, "Hi, my name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." But when the urge was absent, it didn't feel like the truth. During these periods, he wasn't actually dry. He could and did drink. Drink, that was, as opposed to boozing. A couple of cocktails around 5, if he was at a faculty function or a faculty dinner party. Just that and no more. Or he could call Bobby Anderson and ask if she'd like to come over and go out for a couple of cold ones, and it was fine. No sweat. Then there would come a morning like this, when he would wake up wanting all the booze in the world. This seemed to be an actual thirst, a physical thing. It made him think of those cartoons Virgil Parch used to do in the Saturday Evening Post, the ones where some funky old prospector is always crawling across the desert, his tongue hanging out, looking for a water hole. All he could do when the urge came on him was fight it off, stand it off, try to earn a draw. Sometimes it was actually better to be in a place like Boston when this happened, because you could go to a meeting every night, every 4 hours, if that was what it took. After 3 or 4 days, it would go away. Usually. He would, he thought, just wait it out, sit in his room and watch movies on cable TV and charge them to room service. He had spent the 8 years since his divorce and severance from college teaching as a full-time poet, which meant he had come to live in an odd little sub-society where barter was usually more important than money. He had traded poems for food. On one occasion, a birthday sonnet for a farmer's wife in exchange for 3 shopping bags of new potatoes. "Goddamn thing better rhyme, too," the farmer had said, fixing a stony eye upon Gardner. "Real poems rhyme." Gardner, who could take a hint, especially when his stomach was concerned, composed a sonnet so filled with exuberant masculine rhymes that he burst into gales of laughter after scanning the second draft. He called Bobby, read it to her, and they both howled. It was even better out loud. Out loud, it sounded like a love letter from Dr. Seuss. But he hadn't needed Bobby to point out to him that it was still an honest piece of work, jangly, but not condescending. On another occasion, a small press in West Minot had agreed to publish a book of his poems. This had been in early 1983, and was, in fact, the last book of poems Gardner had published, and offered 1/2 cord of wood as an advance. Gardner took it. "You should have held out for 3/4 of a cord, Bobby had told him that night, as they sat in front of her stove, feet up on the fender, smoking cigarettes as the wind shrieked fresh snow across the fields and into the trees. "Those are good poems. There's a lot of them, too." "I know," Gardner said, "but I was cold. 1/2 cord will get me through until spring." He dropped her a wink. "Besides, the guy's from Connecticut. I don't think he knew most of it was ash." She dropped her feet to the floor and stared at him. "You kidding?"
Nope.
She began to giggle, and he kissed her soundly, and later took her to bed, and they slept together like spoons. He remembered waking up once, listening to the wind, thinking of all the dark and rushing cold outside and all the warmth of this bed, filled with their peaceful heat under two quilts, and wishing it could be like this forever. Only nothing ever was. He had been raised to believe God was love. But you had to wonder how loving a God could be when he made men and women smart enough to land on the moon, but stupid enough to have to learn there was no such thing as forever, over and over again. The next day, Bobby had again offered money, and Gardner again refused. He wasn't exactly rolling in dough, but he made out. And he couldn't help the little spark of anger he felt in spite of her matter-of-fact tone. "Don't you know who's supposed to get the money after a night in bed?" he asked. She stuck out her chin. "You calling me a whore?" He smiled. "You need a pimp? There's money in it, I hear. You want breakfast, guard, or do you want to piss me off? How about both?" "No," she said, and he saw she was really mad. Christ, he was getting worse and worse at seeing things like that, and it used to be so easy. He hugged her. "I was only kidding. Couldn't she see that?" he thought. "She always used to be able to tell when I was kidding." But, of course, she hadn't known he was kidding because he hadn't been. If he believed different, the only one getting kidded was himself. He had been trying to hurt her because she embarrassed him. And it wasn't her offer that had been stupid, it was his embarrassment. He had more or less chosen the life he was living, hadn't he? And he didn't want to hurt Bobby, didn't want to drive Bobby away. The bed part was fine, but the bed part wasn't the really important part. The really important part was that Bobby Anderson was a friend, and something scary seemed to be happening just lately. How fast he seemed to be running out of friends. That was pretty scary, all right. Running out of friends, or running them out? Which is it, guard? At first, hugging her was like hugging an ironing board, and he was afraid she would try to pull away and he would make the mistake of trying to hold on. But she finally softened. "I want breakfast," he said, "and to say I'm sorry." "It's all right," she said, and turned away before he could see her face. But her voice held that dry briskness that meant she was either crying or near it. "I keep forgetting it's bad manners to offer money to Yankees." Well, he didn't know if it was bad manners or not, but he would not take money from Bobby. Never had, never would. The New England Poetry Caravan, however, was a different matter. "Grab that chicken, son," Ron Cummings, who needed money about as much as the Pope needed a new hat, would have said. "The bitch is too slow to run and too fat to pass up." The New England Poetry Caravan paid cash, coin of the realm for poetry, 200 up front and 200 at the end of the tour. The word made flesh, you might say, but hard cash, it was understood, was only part of the deal. The rest was the tab. While you were on tour, you took advantage of every opportunity. You got your meals from room service, your hair cut in the hotel barbershop, if there was one, brought your extra pair of shoes, if you had one, and put them out one night instead of your regulars so you could get the extras shined up. There were the in-room movies, movies you never got a chance to see in a theater because theaters persisted in wanting money for much the same thing poets, even the very good ones, were for some reason supposed to provide for free or next to it. 3 bags of spuds equals 1 sonnet, for instance. There was a room charge for the movies, of course, but what of that? You didn't even have to put them on the tab. Some computer did it automatically. And all Gardner had to say on the subject was, "God bless and keep the tab and bring those fuckers on." He watched everything, from Emmanuel in New York, finding the part where the girl flogs the guy's doggy under a table at Windows on the World, particularly artistic and uplifting. It certainly uplifted part of him, anyway. To Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, to Rainbow Bright and the Star Stealer. "And that's what I'm going to do now," he thought, rubbing his throat and thinking about the taste of good aged whiskey. "Exactly what I'm going to do. Just sit here and watch them all over again, even rainbow bright. And for lunch, I'm going to order 3 bacon cheeseburgers and eat one cold at 3 o'clock. Maybe skip rainbow bright and take a nap. Stay in tonight. Go to bed early. And stand it off. Bobby Anderson tripped over a 3-inch tongue of metal protruding from the earth. Jim Gardner tripped over Ron Cummings. Different objects, same result. For want of a nail. Ron popped in around the same time that, some 210 miles away, Anderson and Peter were finally getting home from their less-than-normal trip to the vets. Cummings suggested they go down to the hotel bar and have a drink or 10. Or, Ron continued brightly, we could just skip the foreplay and get shit-faced. If he had put it more delicately, Gard might have been okay. Instead, he found himself in the bar with Ron Cummings, raising a jolly Jack Daniels to his lips and telling himself the old one about how he could choke it off when he really wanted to. Ron Cummings was a good, serious poet who just happened to have money practically falling out of his asshole, or so he often told people. I am my own de Medici, he would say. I have money practically falling out of my asshole. His family had been in textiles for roughly 900 years and owned most of southern New Hampshire. They thought Ron was crazy, but because he was the second son and because the first one was not crazy, i.e. uninterested in textiles, they let Ron do what he wanted to do, which was write poems, read poems, and drink almost constantly. He was a narrow young man with a TB face. Gardner had never seen him eat anything but beer nuts and goldfish crackers. To his dubious credit, he had no idea of Gardner's own problem with booze, or the fact that he had once come very close to killing his wife while drunk. Okay, Gardner said, I'm up for it, let's get faced. After a few in the hotel bar, Ron suggested that a couple of smart fellows like them could find a place with entertainment a tad more exciting than the piped-in muzak drifting down from the overhead speakers. I think my heart can take it, Ron said. I mean, I'm not sure, but... God hates a coward, Gardner finished. Ron cackled, clapped him on the back, and called for the tab. He signed it with a flourish and then added a generous tip from his money clip. Let's boogie, my man! And off they went. The late afternoon sun lanced Gardner's eyes like glass spears, and it suddenly occurred to him that this might be a bad idea. Listen, Ron, he said, I think maybe I'll just... Cummings clapped him on the shoulder, formerly pale cheeks flushed, formerly watery blue eyes blazing. To Gard, Cummings now looked rather like the Toad of Toad Hall after the acquisition of his motor car, and cajoled, Don't crap out of me now, Jim. Boston lies before us, so various anew, glistening like the fresh ejaculate of a young boy's first wet dream. Gardner burst into helpless gales of laughter. That's more like the Gardner we've all come to know and love, Ron said, cackling himself. God hates a coward, Gard said. Hail us a cab, Ronnie. He saw it then, the funnel in the sky, big and black and getting closer. Soon it was going to touch down and carry him away. Not to Oz, though. A cab pulled over to the curb. They got in. The driver asked them where they wanted to go. Oz, Gardner muttered. Ron cackled. What he means is some place where they drink fast and dance faster. Think you can manage that? Oh, I think so, the driver said, and pulled out. Gardner draped an arm around Ron's shoulders and cried, Let the wild rumpus start. I'll drink to that, Ron said. 2. Gardner awoke the next morning fully dressed in a tub full of cold water. His best set of clothes, which he'd had the misfortune to be wearing when he and Ron Cummings set sail the day before, were bonding themselves slowly to his skin. He looked at his fingers and saw they were very white and very pruny. Fish fingers. He'd been in here for a while, apparently. The water might even have been hot when he climbed in, he didn't remember. He opened the tub drain, saw a bottle of bourbon standing on the toilet seat. It was half full, its surface bleary with some sort of grease. He picked it up. The grease smelled vaguely of fried chicken. Gardner was more interested in the aroma coming from inside the bottle. Don't do this, he thought. But the neck of the bottle was rapping against his teeth before the thought was even half finished. He had a drink. Blacked out again. When he came to, he was standing naked in his bedroom, with the phone to his ear and the vague idea that he had just finished dialing a number. Whose? He had no idea until Cummings answered. Cummings sounded even worse than Gardner felt. Gardner would have sworn this was impossible. How bad was it? Gardner heard himself ask. It was always this way when he was in the grip of the cyclone. Even when he was conscious, everything seemed to have the gray, grainy texture of a tabloid photograph, and he never seemed to exactly be inside of himself. A lot of the time he seemed to be floating above his own head, like a kid's silvery puffer balloon. How much trouble did we get into? Trouble? Cummings repeated, and then fell silent. At least Gardner thought he was thinking, hoped he was thinking, or maybe dreaded the idea. He waited, his hands very cold. No trouble, Cummings said at last, and Gard relaxed a little. Except for my head, that is. I got my head in plenty of trouble. Jesus! You sure? Nothing? Nothing at all? He was thinking of Nora. Shot your wife, huh? A voice spoke up suddenly in his mind, the voice of the deputy with the comic book. Good fucking deal. Well, Cummings said reflectively and then stopped. Gardner's hand clenched tight on the phone again. Well, what? Suddenly the lights in the room were too bright, like the sun when they had stepped out of the hotel late yesterday afternoon. You did something. You had another fucking blackout and did another stupid thing, or crazy thing, or horrible thing. When are you going to learn to leave it alone? Or can you learn? An exchange from an old movie clanged stupidly into his mind. Evil El Comandante. Tomorrow before daybreak, senor, you will be dead. You have seen the sun for the last time. Brave Americano. Yeah, but you'll be bald for the rest of your life. What was it? He asked Ron. What did I do?
You got into an argument with some guys at a place called the Stone Country Bar and Grill, Cummings said. He laughed a little. Ow! Christ, when it hurts to laugh, you know you abused yourself. You remember the Stone Country Bar and Grill and them thar good old boys, James, my dear?
He said he didn't. Really straining, he could remember a place called Smith Brothers. The sun had just been going down in a kettle of blood, and this being late June, that meant it had been, what, 8:30, quarter of nine? About 5 hours after he and Ron had gotten started, give or take. He could remember the sign outside bore the likeness of the famous cough drop siblings. He could remember arguing furiously about Wallace Stevens with Cummings, shouting to be heard over the juke, which had been thundering out something by John Fogerty. That was where the last jagged edges of memory came to a halt.
It was the place with the Waylon Jennings for President bumper sticker over the bar, Cummings said. That refreshed the old noggin?
No, Gardner said miserably.
Well, you got into an argument with a couple of the good old boys. Words were passed. These words grew first warm and then hot. A punch was thrown.
By me? Gardner's voice was now only dull.
By you, Cummings agreed cheerfully. At which point we flew through the air with the greatest of ease, landing on the sidewalk. I thought we got off pretty cheap, to tell you the truth. You had them frothing, Jim.
Was it about Seabrook or Chernobyl?
Shit, you do remember.
If I remembered, I wouldn't be asking you which one it was.
As a matter of fact, it was both.
Cummings hesitated.
Are you all right, Gard? You sound real low.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Ron, I'm way up. Up in the cyclone, going around and around and up and down, and where it ends, nobody knows. I'm okay.
That's good. One hopes you know who you have to thank for it.
You, maybe?
None other.
Man, I landed on that sidewalk like a kid hitting the ground for the first time he comes off the end of a slide. I can't quite see my ass in the mirror, but that's probably a good thing. I bet it looks like a Dayglow Grateful Dead poster from 69. But you wanted to go back in and talk about how all the kids around Chernobyl were going to be dead of leukemia in 5 years. You wanted to talk about how some guys almost blew up Arkansas looking for faulty wiring with a candle in a nuclear power plant. You said they caught the place on fire. Me, I'd bet my watch, and it's a Rolex, that they were Snopeses from MISSIPPI. Only way I could get you into a cab was by telling you we'd come back later and bust heads. I sweet-talked you up to your room and started the tub for you. You said you were all right. You said you were going to take a bath and then call some guy named Bobby.
The guy's a girl, Gardner said absently. He was rubbing his right temple with his free hand.
Good-looking?
Pretty. No knockout.
An errant thought, nonsensical but perfectly concrete. Bobby's in trouble, kicked across his mind the way an errant billiard ball will roll across the clean green felt of a pool table. Then it was gone. 3. He walked slowly over to a chair and sat down, now massaging both temples. The nukes. Of course it had been the nukes. What else? If it wasn't Chernobyl, it was Seabrook. And if it wasn't Seabrook, it was 3 Mile Island. And if it wasn't 3 Mile Island, it was Maine Yankee and was Cassett. Or what could have happened at the Hanford plant in Washington State if someone hadn't happened to notice, just in the nick of time, that their used core rods, stored in an unlined ditch outside, were getting ready to blow sky high. How many nicks of time could there be? Spent fuel rods that were stacking up in big hot piles. They thought the curse of King Tut was bad? Brother, wait until some 25th century archaeologist dug up a load of this shit. You tried to tell people the whole thing was a lie. Nothing but a bald-faced, naked lie. That nuclear-generated power was eventually going to kill millions and render huge tracts of land sterile and unlivable. What you got back was a blank stare. You talked to people who had lived through one administration after another in which their elected officials told one lie after another, then lied about the lies. And when those lies were found out, the liars said, "Oh, geez, I forgot. Sorry." And since they forgot, the people who elected them behaved like Christians and forgave. You couldn't believe there were so many fucking many of them willing to do that until you remembered what P.T. Barnum said about the extraordinarily high birth rate of suckers. They looked you square in the face when you tried to tell them the truth and informed you that you were full of shit. The American government didn't tell lies. Not telling lies was what made America great. Oh, dear father, here's the facts. I did it with my little axe. I can't keep silent, for it was I, and come what may, I cannot tell a lie. When you tried to talk to them, they looked at you as if you were babbling in a foreign language. It had been 8 years since he had almost killed his wife, and 3 since he and Bobby had been arrested at Seabrook, Bobby on the general charge of illegal demonstration, Guard on a much more specific one, possession of a concealed and unlicensed handgun. The others paid a fine and got out. Gardner did 2 months. His lawyer told him he was lucky. Gardner asked his lawyer if he knew he was sitting on a time bomb and jerking his meat. His lawyer asked him if he had considered psychiatric help. Gardner asked his lawyer if he had ever considered getting stuffed. But he had had sense enough not to attend any more demonstrations. That much, anyway. He kept away from them. They were poisoning him. When he got drunk, however, his mind, whatever the booze had left of it, returned obsessively to the subject of the reactors, the core rods, the containments, the inability to slow down a runaway once it really got going. To nukes, in other words. When he got drunk, his heart got hot. The nukes. The goddamn nukes. It was symbolic. Yeah, okay. You didn't have to be Freud to figure that what he was really protesting was the reactor in his own heart. When it came to matters of restraint, James Gardner had a bad containment system. There was some technician inside who should have long since been fired. He sat and played with all the wrong switches. That guy wouldn't be really happy until Jim Gardner went China syndrome. The goddamn fucking nukes. Forget it. He tried. For a start, he tried thinking about tonight's reading at Northeastern. A fun-filled frolic that was being sponsored by a group that called itself the Friends of Poetry. A name which filled Gardner with fear and trembling. Groups with such names tended to be made up exclusively of women who called themselves ladies, most of them of a decidedly blue-haired persuasion. The ladies of the club tended to be a good deal more familiar with the works of Rod McEwen than those of John Barrowman, Hart Crane, Ron Cummings, or that other good old drunken blackout brawler and wife-shooter, James Eric Gardner. Get out of here, Gard. Never mind the New England Poetry Caravan. Never mind Northeastern or the Friends of Poetry or the McCardle bitch. Get out of here right now before something bad happens, something really bad. Because if you stay, something really bad will. There's blood on the moon. But he was damned if he'd go running back to Maine with his tail between his legs. Not him. Besides, there was the bitch. Patricia McCardle was her name. And if she wasn't one strutting, world-class bitch, Gard had never met one. She had a contract, and it specified no play, no pay. Jesus, Gardner said, and put a hand over his eyes, trying to shut away the growing headache, knowing there was only one kind of medicine that would do that, and also knowing it was exactly the sort of medicine that could bring that really bad thing on. And also knowing that knowing would do no good at all. So, after a while, the booze started to flow and the cyclone started to blow. Jim Gardner, now in freefall. 4. Patricia McCardle was the New England Poetry Caravan's principal contributor and head ramrod. Her legs were long but skinny, her nose aristocratic but too blade-like to be considered attractive. Gard had once tried to imagine kissing her, and had been horrified by the image which had risen unbidden in his mind. Her nose not just sliding up his cheek, but slicing it open like a razor blade. She had a high forehead, non-existent breasts, and eyes as gray as a glacier on a cloudy day. She traced her ancestry back to the Mayflower. Gardner had worked for her before, and there had been trouble before. He had become part of the 1988 New England Poetry Caravan in rather grisly fashion, but the reason for his abrupt inclusion was no more unheard of in the world of poetry than it was in those of jazz and rock and roll. Patricia McCardle had been left with a last-minute hole in her announced program because one of the six poets who had signed on for this summer's happy cruise had hung himself in his closet with his belt. Just like Phil Ochs, Ron Cummings had said to Gardner as they sat near the back of the bus on the first day of the tour. He said it with a nervous bad boy at the back of the classroom giggle. But then, Bill Clotsworth always was a derivative son of a bitch. Patricia McCardle had gotten 12 reading dates and fairly good advances on a deal which, when stripped of all the high-flown rhetoric, boiled down to 6 poets for the price of 1. Following Clotsworth's suicide, she found herself with 3 days to find a publishing poet in a season when most publishing poets were booked solid, or on permanent vacation, like Silly Billy Clotsworth, Cummings said, laughing rather uneasily. Few, if any, of the booked groups would balk at paying the stipulated fee just because the caravan happened to be short one poet. To do such a thing would be in rather shitty taste, particularly when one considered the reason the caravan was a poet short. All the same, it put Caravan Inc. in a position of contractual default, at least technically, and Patricia McCardle was not a woman to brook loopholes. After trying 4 poets, each more minor league than the last, and with only 36 hours before the first reading, she had finally called Jim Gardner. "Are you still drinking, Jimmy?" she asked bluntly. Jimmy, he hated that. Most people called him Jim. Jim was all right. No one called him guard except himself and Bobby Anderson. Drinking a little, he said, not binging at all. I'm dubious, she said coldly. You always have been, Patty, he replied, knowing she hated that even more than he did Jimmy. Her Puritan blood screamed against it. Were you asking because you happened to be short a quart, or did you have a more pressing reason? Of course he knew, and of course she knew he knew, and of course she knew he was grinning, and of course she was infuriated, and of course all this tickled him just about to death, and of course she knew he knew that, too, and that was just the way he liked it. They sparred a few more minutes, and then came to what was not a marriage of convenience, but one of necessity. Gardner wanted to buy a good used wood furnace for the coming winter. He was tired of living like a slut, bundled up at night in front of the kitchen stove while the wind rattled the plastic stapled over the windows. Patricia McCardle wanted to buy a poet. There would be no handshake agreement, though, not with Patricia McCardle. She had driven down from Derry that afternoon with a contract, in triplicate, and a notary public. Guard was a little surprised she hadn't brought a second notary, just in case the first one happened to suffer a coronary or something. Feelings and hunches aside, there was really no way he could leave the tour and get the wood furnace, because if he left the tour, he would never see the second half of his fee. She'd haul him into court and spend $1,000 trying to get him to cough up the 300 Caravan Inc. had paid him up front. She might be able to do it, too. He had done almost all the dates, but the contract he had signed was crystal clear on the subject. If he took off, for any reason unacceptable to the tour coordinator, any and all fees unpaid shall be declared null and void, and any and all fees prepaid shall be refundable to Caravan Inc. within 30 days. And she would go after him. She might think she was doing it on principle, but it would really be because he had called her Patty in her hour of need. Nor would that be the end of it. If he left, she would work with unflagging energy to get him blackballed. He would certainly never read again for another poetry tour with which she was associated, and that was a lot of poetry tours. Then there was the delicate matter of grants. Her husband had left her a lot of money, although he didn't think you could say, as Ron Cummings did, that she practically had money falling out of her asshole, because Gar didn't believe Patricia McCardle had anything so vulgar as an asshole, or even a rectum. When in need of relief, she probably performed an act of immaculate excretion. Patricia McCardle had taken a great deal of this money and set up a number of grants in aid. This made her simultaneously a serious patron of the arts and an extremely smart businesswoman in regard to the nasty business of income taxes. The grants were write-offs. Some of them funded poets for specific time periods. Some funded cash poetry awards and prizes, and some underwrote magazines of modern poetry and fiction. The grants were administered by committees. Behind each of them moved the hand of Patricia McCardle, making sure that they meshed as neatly as the pieces of a Chinese puzzle, or the strands of a spider's web. She could do a lot more to him than get back her lousy $600. She could muzzle him. And it was just possible, unlikely but possible, that he might write a few more good poems before the madmen who had stuffed a shotgun up the asshole of the world decided to pull the trigger. So get through it, he thought. He had ordered a bottle of Johnny Walker from room service. God bless the tab forever and ever, amen. And now he poured his second drink with a hand that had become remarkably steady. Get through it, that's all. But as the day wore on, he kept thinking about grabbing a Greyhound bus at the Stewart Street terminal and getting off 5 hours later in front of the dusty little drugstore in Unity, thumbing a ride up to Troy from there, calling Bobby Anderson on the phone and saying, I almost went up in the cyclone, Bobby, but I found the storm cellar just in time. Lucky break, huh? Shit on that. You make your own luck. If you be strong guard, you be lucky. Get through it, that's all. That's what to do. He scrummed through his tote bag, looking for the best clothes he had left, since his reading clothes appeared to be beyond salvage. He tossed a pair of faded jeans, a plain white shirt, a tattered pair of skivvies, and a pair of socks onto the bedspread. Thanks, ma'am,
There's no need to make up the room. I slept in the tub. He got dressed, ate some certs, ate some booze, ate some more certs, and then went through the bag again, this time looking for the aspirin. He found it and ate some of those. He looked at the bottle, looked away. The pulse of the headache was getting worse. He sat down by the window with his notebooks, trying to decide what he should read that night. In this dreadful long afternoon light, all his poems looked as if they had been written in Punic. Instead of doing anything positive about his headache, the aspirin seemed to actually be intensifying it. Slam, bam, thank you, ma'am. His head whacked with each heartbeat. It was the same old headache, the one that felt like an auger made of dull steel being slowly driven into his head at a point slightly above and to the left of his left eye. He touched the tips of his fingers to the faint scar there and ran his fingers lightly along it. The steel plate buried under the skin there was the result of a skiing accident in his teens. He remembered the doctor saying, "You may suffer headaches from time to time, son. When they come, just thank God you can feel anything. You're lucky to be alive." But at times like this, he wondered. Times like this, he wondered a lot. He put the notebooks aside with a shaking hand and closed his eyes. "I can't get through it." "You can." "I can't. There's blood on the moon. I feel it. I can almost see it." "Don't give me any of your Irish willy-wags. Just get tough, you weak fucking sister. Tough." "I'll try," he muttered, not opening his eyes. And 15 minutes later, when his nose began to bleed slightly, he didn't notice. He had fallen asleep in the chair. 5. He always got stage fright before reading, even if the group was a small one, and groups which turned out to hear readings of modern poetry tended to be just that. On the night of June 27th, however, Jim Gardner's stage fright was intensified by his headache. When he woke from his nap in the hotel room chair, the shakes and the fluttery stomach were gone, but the headache had gotten even worse. It had graduated to a genuine Class A thumper and world beater, maybe the worst of all time. When his turn to read finally came, he seemed to hear himself from a great distance. He felt a little like a man listening to a recording of himself on a shortwave broadcast coming in from Spain or Portugal. Then a wave of lightheadedness coursed through him, and for a few moments he could only pretend to be looking for a poem, some special poem, perhaps, that had been temporarily misplaced. He shuffled papers with dim and nerveless fingers, thinking, "I'm going to faint, I think, right up here in front of everyone, fall against this lectern, and pitch both it and me into the front row. Maybe I can land on that blue-blooded cunt and kill her. That would almost make my whole life seem worthwhile." "Get through it," that implacable inner voice responded. Sometimes that voice sounded like his father's. More often it sounded like the voice of Bobby Anderson. "Get through it, that's all. That's what to do." The audience that night was larger than usual. Maybe 100 people squeezed behind the desks of a northeastern lecture hall. Their eyes seemed too big. "What big eyes you have, Grandma." It was as if they would eat him up with their eyes, suck out his soul, his ka, his whatever he wanted to call it. A snatch of old T-Rex occurred to him. Of course, there was no more T-Rex. Mark Bolan had wrapped his sports car around a tree and was lucky not to be alive. "Bang a gong, Mark. You sure got it on. Or got it off, or whatever. A group called Power Station is going to cover your tune in 1986, and it's going to be really bad. It. He raised an unsteady hand to his forehead, and a quiet murmur ran through the audience. "Better get going, guard. Natives are getting restless." Yeah, that was Bobby's voice, all right. The fluorescence, embedded in pebbled rectangles overhead, seemed to be pulsing in cycles which perfectly matched the cycles of pain driving into his head. He could see Patricia McCardle. She was wearing a little black dress that surely hadn't cost a penny more than $300, distress sale stuff from one of those tacky little shops on Newbury Street. Her face was as narrow and pallid and unforgiving as that of any of her Puritan forebears, those wonderful, fun-loving guys,
who had been more than happy to stick you in some stinking jail for 3 or 4 weeks if you had the bad luck to be spied on going out on the Sabbath day without a snot rag in your pocket. Patricia's dark eyes lay upon him like dusty stones, and Guard thought, "She sees what's happening, and she couldn't be more pleased. Look at her. She's waiting for me to fall down. And when I do, you know what she'll be thinking, don't you?" Of course he did. "That's what you get for calling me Patty, you drunken son of a bitch." That was what she would be thinking. "That's what you get for calling me Patty. That's what you get for doing everything but making me get down on my knees and beg. So go on, Gardner. Maybe I'll even let you keep the upfront money. $300 seems a cheap enough price to pay for the exquisite pleasure of watching you crack up in front of all these people. Go on. Go on and get it over with." Some members of the audience were becoming visibly uneasy now. The delay between poems had stretched out far beyond what might be considered normal. The murmur had become a muted buzz. Gardner heard Ron Cummings clear his throat uneasily behind him. "Get tough," Bobby's voice yelled again. But the voice was fading now, fading, getting ready to high-side it. He looked at their faces and saw only pasty-pale, blank circles, ciphers, big white holes in the universe. The buzz was growing. He stood at the podium, swaying noticeably now, wetting his lips, looking at his audience with a kind of numb dismay. And then, suddenly, instead of hearing Bobby, Gardner actually saw her. This image had all the force of vision. Bobby was up there in Haven, up there right now. He saw her sitting in her rocking chair, wearing a pair of shorts and a halter top over what boobs she had, which wasn't much. There was a pair of battered old mocks on her feet, and Peter was curled before them, deeply asleep. She had a book, but wasn't reading it. It lay open, face down in her lap. This fragment of vision was so perfect, Gardner could even read the book's title. It was Watchers by Dean Kuntz. While Bobby looked out the window into the dark, thinking her own thoughts, thoughts which would follow one after the other as sanely and rationally as you could want a train of thought to run. No derailments, no late freights, no head-ons. Bobby knew how to run a railroad. He even knew what she was thinking about, he discovered. Something in the woods, something. It was something she had found in the woods. Yes. Bobby was in Haven, trying to decide what that thing might be and why she felt so tired. She was not thinking about James Eric Gardner, the noted poet, protester, and Thanksgiving wife-shooter, who was currently standing in a lecture hall at Northeastern University under these lights with 5 other poets and some fat shit named Arberg or Argle-bargle or something like that and getting ready to faint. Here, in this lecture hall, stood the master of disaster. God bless Bobby, who had somehow managed to keep her shit together while all about her people were losing theirs. Bobby was up there in Haven, thinking the way people were supposed to think. No, she's not. She's not doing that at all. Then, for the first time, the thought came through with no soundproofing around it. It came through as loud and urgent as a fireball in the night. Bobby's in trouble. Bobby's in real trouble. This surety struck him with the force of a roundhouse slap, and suddenly the lightheadedness was gone. He fell back into himself with such a thud he almost seemed to feel his teeth rattle. A sickening bolt of pain ripped through his head, but even that was welcome. If he felt pain, then he was back here. Here, not drifting around someplace in the ozone. And for one puzzling moment he saw a new picture. Very brief, very clear, and very ominous. It was Bobby in the cellar of the farmhouse she had inherited from her uncle. She was hunkered down in front of some piece of machinery, working on it. Or was she? It seemed so dark. And Bobby wasn't much of a hand with mechanical stuff. But she sure was doing something, because ghostly blue fire leapt and flickered between her fingers as she fiddled with tangled wires inside. But it was too dark to see what that dark cylindrical shape was. It was familiar, something he had seen before, but then he could hear as well as see, although what he heard was even less comforting than that eldritch blue fire. It was Peter. Peter was howling. Bobby took no notice, and that was utterly unlike her. She only went on fiddling with the wires, jiggering them so they would do something down there in the root-smelling dark of the cellar. The vision broke apart on rising voices. The faces which went with those voices were no longer white holes in the universe, but the faces of real people. Some were amused, but not many. A few more embarrassed, but most just seemed alarmed or worried. Most looked, in other words, the way he would have looked had his position been reversed with one of them. Had he been afraid of them? Had he? If so, why? Only Patricia McCardle didn't fit. She was looking at him with a quiet, sure satisfaction that brought him all the way back. Gardner suddenly spoke to the audience, surprised at how natural and pleasant his voice sounded. "I'm sorry, please excuse me. I've got a batch of new poems here, and I went wool-gathering among them, I'm afraid." Pause. Smile. Now he could see some of the worried ones settling back, looking relieved. There was a little laughter, but it was sympathetic. He could, however, see a flush of anger rising in Patricia McCardle's cheeks, and it did his headache a world of good. "Actually," he went on, "even that's not the truth. Fact is, I was trying to decide whether or not to read some of this new stuff to you. After some furious sparring between those two thundering heavyweights, Pride of Authorship and Prudence, Prudence has won a split decision. Pride of Authorship vows to appeal the decision." More laughter, heartier. Now old Patty's cheeks looked like his kitchen stove through its little isinglass windows on a cold winter night. Her hands were locked together, the knuckles white. Her teeth weren't quite bared, but almost, friends and neighbors, almost. "In the meantime, I'm going to finish with a dangerous act. I'm going to read a fairly long poem from my first book, Grimoire." He winked in Patricia McCardle's direction, then took them all into his humorous confidence. "But God hates a coward, right?" Ron snorted laughter behind him, and then they were all laughing. And for a moment he actually did see a glint of her pearly whites behind those stretched, furious lips. And oh boy, howdy, that was just about as good as you'd want, wasn't it? "Watch out for her, guard. You think you've got your boot on her neck now, and maybe you even do for the moment, but watch out for her. She won't forget. Or forgive." But that was for later. Now he opened the battered copy of his first book of poems. He didn't need to look for Leighton Street. The book fell open to it of its own accord. His eyes found the subscript, "For Bobby, who first smelled sage in New York." Leighton Street had been written the year he met her, the year Leighton Street was all she could talk about. It was, of course, the street in Utica where she had grown up, the street she'd needed to escape before she could even start being what she wanted to be, a simple writer of simple stories. She could do that. She could do that with flash and ease. Gard had known that almost at once. Later that year, he had sensed that she might be able to do more, to surmount the careless, profligate ease with which she wrote, and do, if not great work, brave work. But first, she had to get away from Leighton Street. Not the real one, but the Leighton Street which she carried with her in her mind. A demon geography populated by haunted tenements, her sick, loved father, her weak, loved mother, and her defiant crone of a sister, who rode over them all like a demon of endless power. Once that year she had fallen asleep in class, freshman comp that had been. He had been gentle with her because he already loved her a little, and he had seen the huge circles under her eyes. "I've had problems sleeping at night," she said, when he held her after class for a moment. She had still been half asleep, or she never would have gone on from there. That was how powerful Anne's hold, which was the hold of Leighton Street, had been over her. But she was like a person who has been drugged and exists with one leg thrown over each side of the sleep's dark and stony wall. "I almost fall asleep, and then I hear her." "Who?" he asked gently. "Sissy. My sister Anne, that is. She grinds her teeth, and it sounds like b-b-b-b-bones," she wanted to say. But then she woke into a fit of hysterical weeping, and that had frightened him very badly. Anne. More than anything else, Anne was Layton Street. Anne had been, knocking at the door, the gag of Bobby's needs and ambitions. Okay, Guard thought. For you, Bobby. Only for you. And began to read Layton Street as smoothly as if he had spent the afternoon rehearsing it in his room. These streets begin where the cobbles surface through tar like the heads of children buried badly in their textures. Gardner read. What myth is this? We ask. But the children who play stickball and Johnny Jump My Pony round here just laugh. No myth, they tell us. No myth. Just, they say, hey, motherfucker, ain't nothing but Layton Street here. Ain't nothing but all small houses. Ain't only but back porches where our mothers wash there and there and there. Where days grow hot. And on Layton Street they listen to the radio, while pterodactyls flow between the TV aerials on the roof, and they say, hey, motherfucker, they say, hey, motherfucker. No myth, they tell us, no myth. Just, they say, hey, motherfucker, ain't nothing but Layton Street around here. This, they say, is how you be silent in your silence of days. Motherfucker. When we turned our back on these upstate roads, warehouses with faces of blank brick, when you say, oh, but I have reached the end of all I know and still hear her grinding, grinding in the night. Because it had been so long since he had read the poem, even to himself, he did not just perform it, something he had discovered that was almost impossible not to do at the end of a tour such as this. He rediscovered it. Most of those who came to the reading at Northwestern that night, even those who witnessed the evening's sordid, creepy conclusion, agreed that Gardner's reading of Layton Street had been the best of the night. A good many of them maintained it was the best they had ever heard, since it was the last reading Jim Gardner would ever give in his life. It was maybe not such a bad way to go out. 6. It took him nearly 20 minutes to read all of it, and when he finished, he looked up uncertainly into a deep and perfect well of silence. He had time to think he had never read the damned thing at all, that it had just been a vivid hallucination in the moment or two before the faint. Then someone stood up and began to clap steadily and hard. It was a young man with tears on his cheeks. The girl beside him also stood and began to clap, and she was also crying. Then they were all standing and applauding. Yeah, they were giving him a fucking standing O, and in their faces he saw what every poet or would-be poet hopes to see when he or she finished reading, the faces of people suddenly awakened from a dream brighter than any reality. They looked as dazed as Bobby had on that day, not quite sure where they were. But they weren't all standing and applauding, he saw. Patricia McArdle sat stiff and straight in her third-row seat, her hands clasped tightly together in her lap over her small evening bag. Her lips had closed, no sign of the old pearly whites now. Her mouth had become a small, bloodless cut. Guard felt a weary amusement. As far as you're concerned, Patty, the real Puritan ethic is no one who's a black sheep should dare rise above his designated level of mediocrity, correct? But there's no mediocrity clause in your contract, is there? Thank you, he muttered into the mic, sweeping his books and papers together into an untidy pile with his shaking hands, and then almost dropping them all over the floor as he stepped away from the podium. He dropped into his seat next to Ron Cummings with a deep sigh. My God, Ron whispered, still applauding. My God! Stop clapping, you ass, Gardner whispered back. Damned if I will. I don't care when you wrote it. It was fucking brilliant, Cummings said. And I'll buy you a drink on it later on. I'm not drinking anything stronger than club soda tonight, Gardner said, and knew it was a lie. His headache was already creeping back. Aspirin wouldn't cure that. Percodan wouldn't. Allude wouldn't. Nothing would fix his head but a great big cloud of booze. Fast, fast relief. The applause was finally beginning to die away. Patricia McArdle looked acidly grateful. 7.
The name of the fat shit who had introduced each of the poets was Arberg, although Gardner kept wanting to call him Argel Bargel, and he was the assistant professor of English who headed the sponsoring group. He was the sort of man his father had called a beefy son of a whore. The beefy son of a whore threw a party for the caravan, the Friends of Poetry, and most of the English department faculty at his house after the reading. It began around 11 o'clock. It was stiffish at first, men and women standing in uncomfortable little groups with glasses and paper plates in their hands talking your usual brand of cautious academic talk. This sort of bullshit had struck Gard as a stupid waste of time when he was teaching. It still did, but there was also something nostalgic and pleasing in a melancholy way about it now. His party monster streak told him that, stiff or not, this was a party with possibilities. By midnight, the Bach etudes would almost certainly be replaced by the pretenders, and talk of classes, politics, and literature would be replaced by more interesting fare. The Red Sox, who on the faculty was drinking too much, and that all-time favorite, who was fucking whom. There was a large buffet for which most of the poets made a beeline, reliably following Gardner's first rule for touring poets: if it's gratis, grab it. As he watched, Anne Delaney, who wrote spare, haunting poems about rural working-class New England, stretched her jaws wide and ripped into the huge sandwich she was holding. Mayonnaise, the color and texture of bull semen, squirted between her fingers, and Anne licked it off her hand nonchalantly. She tipped Gardner a wink. To her left, last year's winner of Boston University's Hawthorne Prize for his long poem Harbor Dreams, 1650-1980, was cramming green olives into his mouth with blurry speed. This fellow, John Everett Symington by name, paused long enough to drop a handful of wrapped mini-wheels of Bonbel cheese into each pocket of his corduroy sport coat, patched elbows naturally, and then went back to the olives. Ron Cummings strolled over to where Gardner was standing. As usual, he wasn't eating. He had a Waterford glass that looked full of straight whiskey in one hand. He nodded toward the buffet. "Great stuff. If you're a connoisseur of Kirshner's bologna and iceberg lettuce, you in like Flynn, bo." "That Argel Bargel really knows how to live," Gardner said. Cummings, in the act of drinking, snorted so hard his eyes bulged. "You're on the hit line tonight, Jim, Argel Bargel, Jesus." He looked at the glass in Gardner's hand. It was vodka and tonic, weak, but his second just the same. "Tonic water?" Cummings asked slyly. "Well, mostly." Cummings laughed again and walked away. By the time someone pulled Bach and put on B.B. King, Gard was working on his fourth drink. On this one, he'd asked the bartender, who had been at the reading, to go a little heavier on the vodka. He had begun to repeat two remarks that seemed wittier as he got drunker. First, that if you were a connoisseur of Kirshner's bologna and iceberg lettuce, you were in like Flynn here, bo. And second, that all assistant professors were like T.S. Eliot's practical cats in at least one way. They all had secret names. Gardner confided that he had intuited that of their host, Argel Bargel. He went back for a fifth drink and told the bartender, "Just to wave the tonic bottle in that old drink's face, that would be fine." The bartender waggled the bottle of Schweppes solemnly in front of Gardner's glass of vodka. Gardner laughed until tears stood in his eyes and his stomach hurt. He really was feeling fine tonight. And who, sir or madam, deserved it more? He had read better than he had in years, maybe in his whole life. "You know," he told the bartender, a needy post-grad hired especially for the occasion, "all assistant professors are like T.S. Eliot's practical cats in one way." "Is that so, Mr. Gardner?" "Jim, just Jim." But he could see from the look in the kid's eyes that he was never going to be just Jim to this guy. Tonight he had seen Gardner blaze, and men who blazed could never be anything so mundane as just Jim. "It is," he told the kid. "Each of them has a secret name. I have intuited that of our host. It's Argel Bargel, like the sound you make when you use the old Listerine." He paused, considering. "Of which the gentleman under discussion could use a good dose, now that I think of it." Gardner laughed quite loudly. It was a fine addition to the basic thrust. Like adding a tasteful hood ornament to a fine car, he thought, and laughed again.
This time a few people glanced around before going back to their conversations. Too loud, he thought. Turn down your volume control, guard, old buddy. He grinned widely, thinking he was having one of those magic nights. Even his damn thoughts were funny tonight. The bartender was also smiling, but his smile had a slightly concerned edge to it. You ought to be careful what you say about Professor Arberg, he said. Or who you say it to. He's a bit of a bear. Oh, is he? Gardner popped his eyes round and waggled his eyebrows energetically up and down like Groucho Marx. Well, he's got the build for it. Beefy son of a whore, ain't he? But he was careful to keep the old volume control down when he said it. Yeah, the bartender said. He looked around and then leaned over the makeshift bar toward Gardner. There's a story that he happened to be passing by the grad assistant's lounge last year and heard one of them joking about how he'd always wanted to be associated with a school where Moby Dick wasn't just another dry classic, but an actual member of the faculty. That guy was one of the most promising English students Northeastern has ever had, I heard, but he was gone before the semester was over. So was everyone who left. The ones who didn't laugh stayed. Jesus Christ, Gardner said. He had heard stories like it before, one or two that were even worse, but still felt disgusted. He followed the bartender's glance and saw Argle Bargle at the buffet standing next to Patricia McCardle. Argle Bargle had a stein of beer in one hand and was gesturing with it. His other hand was plowing potato chips through a bowl of clam dip and then conveying them to his mouth, which went right on talking as it slobbered them chips in. Gardner could not remember ever having seen anything quite so quintessentially disgusting. Yet the McCardle bitch's rapt attention suggested that she might at any moment drop to her knees and give the man a blowjob out of sheer adoration. Gardner thought, and the fat fuck would go right on eating while she did it, dropping potato chip crumbs and globs of clam dip in her hair. Jesus wept, he said, and slugged back half of his vodka sans tonic. It hardly burned at all. What burned was the evening's first real hostility, the first outrider of that mute and inexplicable rage that had plagued him almost since the time he began drinking. Freshen this up, would you? The bartender dumped in more vodka and said shyly, I thought your reading tonight was wonderful, Mr. Gardner. Gardner was absurdly touched. Leighton Street had been dedicated to Bobby Anderson, and this boy behind the bar, barely old enough to drink legally himself, reminded Gardner of Bobby as she had been when she first came to the university. Thank you. You want to be a little careful of that vodka, the bartender said. It has a way of blindsiding you. I'm in control, Gardner said and gave the bartender a reassuring wink. Visibility 10 miles to unlimited. He pushed off from the bar, glancing toward the beefy son of a whore and McCardle again. She caught him looking at her and gazed back, cool and unsmiling, her blue eyes chips of ice. Bite my bag, you frigid bitch, he thought, and raised his drink to her in a boorish barrel-house salute, at the same time favoring her with an insultingly wide grin. Just tonic, right? Pure tonic. He looked around. Ron Cummings had appeared at his side as suddenly as Satan, and his grin was properly satanic. Bugger off, Gardner said, and more people turned around to look. Jim, old buddy, I know, turn down the volume control. He smiled, but he could feel that pulse in his head getting harder, more insistent. It wasn't like the headaches the doctor had predicted following his accident. It didn't come from the front of his head, but rather from someplace deep in the back. And it didn't hurt. It was, in fact, rather pleasant. You got it. Cummings nodded almost imperceptibly toward McCardle. She's got a heavy down on you, Jim. She'd love to dump you off the tour. Don't give her a reason. Fuck her. You fuck her, Cummings said. Cancer, cirrhosis of the liver, and brain damage are all statistically proven results of heavy drinking. So I could reasonably expect any of them in my future, and if one of them were to come down on my head, I'd have no one to blame but myself. Diabetes, glaucoma, and premature senility all run in my family. But hypothermia of the penis, that I can do without. Excuse me?
Gardner stood still for a moment, puzzled, watching him go. Then he got it in brayed laughter. This time the tears did not just stand in his eyes. This time they actually rolled down his cheeks. For the third time that evening, people were looking at him. A big man, in rather shabby clothes, with a glass full of what looked suspiciously like straight vodka, standing by himself and laughing at the top of his voice. Put a lid on it, he thought. Turn down the volume, he thought. Hypothermia of the penis, he thought, and sprayed more laughter. Little by little, he managed to regain control. He headed for the stereo in the other room. That was where the most interesting people at a party were usually found. He grabbed a couple of canapes from a tray and swallowed them. He had a strong feeling that Argelbargle and McGargelbargle were looking at him still, and that McGargelbargle was giving Argelbargle a complete rundown on him in neat phrases, that cool, maddening little smile never leaving her face. You didn't know? Oh, it's quite true. He shot her right through the face. She told him she wouldn't press charges if he would give her an uncontested divorce. Well, who knows if it was the right decision or not? He hasn't shot any more women, or at least not yet. But however well he might have read tonight, after that rather eccentric lapse, I mean, he is unstable, and as you can see, he's not able to control his drinking. Better watch it, guard, he thought. And for the second time that night, a thought came in a voice that was very much like Bobby's. Your paranoia is showing. They're not talking about you, for Christ's sake. At the doorway, he turned and looked back. They were looking directly at him. He felt nasty, dismayed shock race through him. And then he forced another big, insulting grin and tipped his glass toward both of them. Get out of here, guard. This could be bad. You're drunk. I'm in control. Don't worry. She wants me to leave. That's why she keeps looking at me. That's why she's telling that fat fuck all about me, that I shot my wife, that I was busted at Seabrook with a loaded gun in my pack sack. She wants to get rid of me because she doesn't think drunken wife-shooting commie simp nuclear protesters should get the biggest motherfucking hand of the night. But I can be cool. No problem, baby. I'm just going to hang out, taper off on the fire water, grab some coffee, and go home early. No problem. And although he didn't drink any coffee, didn't go home early, and didn't taper off on the fire water, he was okay for the next hour or so. He turned down the volume control every time he heard it start going up, and made himself quit every time he heard himself doing what his wife had called holding forth. When you get drunk, Jim, she had said, not the least of your problems is a tendency to stop conversing and start holding forth. He stayed mostly in Arberg's living room, where the crowd was younger and not so cautiously pompous. Their conversation was lively, cheerful, and intelligent. The thought of the nukes rose in Gardner's mind. At hours such as this, it always did, like a rotting body floating to the surface in response to cannon fire. At hours such as these, and at this stage of drunkenness, the certainty that he must alert these young men and women to the problem always floated up, trailing its heat of anger and irrationality like rotted waterweed. As always. The last 6 years of his life had been bad, and the last three had been a nightmare time in which he had become inexplicable to himself and scary to almost all the people who really knew him. When he drank, this rage, this terror, and most of all, this inability to explain whatever had happened to Jimmy Gardner, to explain even to himself, found outlet in the subject of the nukes. But tonight he had hardly raised the subject when Ron Cummings staggered into the parlor, his narrow, gaunt face glowing with feverish color. Drunk or not, Cummings was still perfectly able to see how the wind was blowing. He adroitly turned the conversation back toward poetry. Gardner was weakly grateful, but also angry. It was irrational, but it was there. He had been denied his fix. So, partly thanks to the tight check rein he had imposed on himself, and partly due to Ron Cummings' timely intervention, Gardner avoided trouble until Arberg's party was almost over. Another half hour, and Gardner might have avoided trouble completely, at least for that night. But when Ron Cummings began to hold forth on the beat poets with his customary cutting wit, Gardner wandered back into the dining room to get another drink, and perhaps something to nosh on from the buffet. What followed might have been arranged by a devil with a particularly malignant sense of humor.
Once we've got Iroquois online, you'll have the equivalent of 36 full scholarships to give away, a voice on Gardner's left was saying. Gardner looked around so suddenly that he almost spilled his drink. Surely he must be imagining this conversation. It was too coincidental to be real. Half a dozen people were grouped at one end of the buffet, 3 men and 3 women. One of the couples was that world-famous vaudeville team of Argle Bargle and McCargle Bargle. The man speaking looked like a car salesman, with better taste in clothes than most of the breed. His wife stood next to him. She was pretty in a strained way, her fading blue eyes magnified by thick spectacles. Gardner saw one thing at once. He might be an alky and obsessive on this one subject, but he had always been a sharp observer, and still was. The woman with the thick spectacles was aware that her husband was doing exactly that which Nora had accused Gard himself of doing at parties once he got drunk, holding forth. She wanted to get her husband out, but as yet couldn't see how to do it. Gardner took a second look and guessed they had been married 8 months. Maybe a year, but 8 months was a better guess. The man speaking had to be some sort of wheel with Bay State Electric. Had to be Bay State, because Bay State owned the boondoggle that was the Iroquois plant. This guy was making it sound like the greatest thing since sliced bread, and because he looked as though he really believed it, Gardner decided he must be a wheel of a rather small sort, maybe even a spare tire. He doubted if the big guys were so crazy about Iroquois. Even putting aside the insanity of nuclear power for a moment, there was the fact that Iroquois was 5 years late coming online, and the fate of 3 interconnected New England bank chains depended on what would happen when, and if, it did. They were all standing chest deep in radioactive quicksand and trading paper. It was like some crazy game of musical chairs. Of course, the courts had finally given the company permission to begin loading hot rods the month before, and Gardner supposed that had the motherfuckers breathing a little easier. Arberg was listening with solemn respect. He wasn't a trustee of the college, but anyone above the post of instructor would know enough to butter up an emissary from Bay State Electric, even a spare tire. Big private utilities like Bay State could do a lot for a school, if they wanted to. Was Reddy Kilowatt here a friend of poetry? About as much Gard suspected as he was a friend of the neutron bomb. His wife, however, she of the thick glasses and the strained, pretty face, she looked like a friend of poetry. Knowing it was a terrible mistake, Gardner drifted over. He was wearing a pleasant, late-in-the-party, gotta-go-soon smile, but the pulse in his head was faster, centering on the left. The old helpless anger was rising in a red wave. "Don't you know what you're talking about?" was almost all that his heart could cry. There were logical arguments against nuclear power plants that he could muster, but at times like this he could only find the inarticulate cry of his heart. "Don't you know what you're talking about? Don't you know what the stakes are? Don't any of you remember what happened in Russia 2 years ago? They haven't. They can't. They'll be burying the cancer victims far into the next century. Jesus," jumped up, fiddling. "Christ, stick one of those used core rods up your ass for half an hour or so and tell everyone how safe nuclear power is when your turds start to glow in the dark. Jesus. Jesus! You jerks are standing here listening to this man talk as if he was sane." He stood there, drink in hand, smiling pleasantly, listening to the spare tire spout his deadly nonsense. The third man in the group was 50 or so and looked like a college dean. He wanted to know about the possibility of further organized protests in the fall. He called the spare tire Ted. Ted, the power man, said he doubted there was much to worry about. Seabrook had had its vogue, and the Arrowhead installation in Maine, but since the federal judges had started to deal out some stiff sentences for what they saw as merely hell-raising, the protesters had slowed down fast. "These groups go through targets almost as fast as they go through rock groups," he said. Arberg, McCardle, and the others laughed, all except the wife of Ted, the power man. Her smile only frayed a little more. Gardner's pleasant smile remained. It felt flash-frozen onto his face. Ted, the power man, grew more expansive. He said it was time to show the Arabs once and for all that America and Americans didn't need them. He said that even the most modern coal-fired generators were too dirty to be acceptable by the EPA. He said that solar power was great, as long as the sun shines. There was another burst of laughter. Gardner's head thudded and whipped, whipped and thudded. His ears, tuned to an almost preternatural pitch, heard a faint crackling sound, like ice shifting, and he relaxed his hand a bare moment before it tightened enough to shatter the glass. He blinked, and Arberg had the head of a pig. This hallucination was utterly complete and utterly perfect, right down to the bristles on the fat man's snout. The buffet was in ruins, but Arberg was scavenging, finishing up the last few triscuits, spearing a final slice of salami and chunk of cheese on the same plastic toothpick, chasing them with the last potato chip crumbs. It all went into his snuffling snout, and he went on nodding all the while as Ted the Power Man explained that nuclear was the only alternative, really. "Thank God the American people are finally getting that Chernobyl business into some kind of perspective," he said. 32 people dead, it's horrible, of course, but there was an airplane crash just a month ago that killed 190-some. You don't hear people yelling for the government to shut down the airlines, though, do you? 32 dead is horrible, but it's far from the Armageddon these nuke freaks made it sound like. He lowered his voice a little. They're as nuts as the LaRouche people you see in airports, but in a way, they're worse. They sound more rational. But if we gave them what they wanted, they'd turn around a month or so later and start whining about not being able to use their blow dryers, or found out their Cuisinarts weren't going to work when they wanted to mix up a bunch of macrobiotic food. To guard, he didn't look like a man anymore. The shaggy head of a wolf poked out of the collar of his white shirt with the narrow red pinstripes. It looked around, pink tongue lolling, greenish-yellow eyes sparkling. Arberg squealed some sort of approval and stuffed more odd lots into his pink pig's snout. Patricia McCardle now had the smooth, sleek head of a whippet. The college dean and his wife were weasels, and the wife of the man from the electric company had become a frightened rabbit, pink eyes rolling behind thick glasses. "Oh, God, no," his mind moaned. He blinked again, and they were just people. And one thing these protesters never remember to mention at their protest rallies is just this, Ted the Power Man finished, looking around at them like a trial lawyer reaching the climax of his summation. In 30 years of peaceful nuclear power development, there has never been one single fatality as the result of nuclear power in the United States of America. He smiled modestly and tossed off the rest of his scotch. "I'm sure we'll all rest easier knowing that," the man who looked like a college dean said. "And now I think my wife and I..." "Did you know that Marie Curie died of radiation poisoning?" Gardner asked conversationally. Heads turned. "Yeah, leukemia induced by direct exposure to gamma rays. She was the first casualty along the death march with this guy's power plant at the end. She did a lot of research and recorded it all." Gardner looked around the suddenly silent room. "Her notebooks are locked up in a vault," he said. "A vault in Paris. It's lead-lined. The notebooks are whole, but too radioactive to touch. As for who's died here, we don't really know. The AEC and the EPA keep a lid on it." Patricia McCardle was frowning at him. With the dean temporarily forgotten, Arberg went back to scrounging along the denuded buffet table. "On the 5th of October, 1966, Gardner said, "there was a partial nuclear meltdown of the Enrico Fermi breeder reactor in Michigan." "Nothing happened," Ted the Power Man said, and spread his hands to the assembled company as if to say, "You see, QED." "No," Gardner said, "nothing did. God may know why, but my guess is no one else does. The chain reaction stopped on its own. No one knows why. One of the engineers the contractors called in took a look, smiled, and said, 'You guys almost lost Detroit.' Then he fainted." "Oh, but Mr. Gardner, that was—" Gardner held up a hand. "When you examine the cancer death stats for the areas surrounding every nuclear power facility in the country, you find anomalies, deaths that are way out of line with the norm. That is utterly untrue, and let me finish, please. I don't think the facts make any difference anymore, but let me finish anyway. Long before Chernobyl, the Russians had an accident at a reactor in a place called Kishtym. But Khrushchev was premier then, and the Soviets kept their lips a lot tighter. Looks like maybe they were storing used rods in a shallow ditch. Why not? As Madame Curie might have said, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Our best guess is that the core rods oxidized, only instead of creating ferrous oxide or rust the way steel rods do, these rods rusted pure plutonium. It was like building a campfire next to a tank filled with LP gas. But they didn't know that. They assumed it would be all right. They assumed. He could hear the rage filling his voice and was helpless to stop it. They assumed. They played with the lives of living human beings as if they were, well, so many dolls. And guess what happened? The room was silent. Patty's mouth was a frozen red slash. Her complexion was milky with rage. It rained, Gardner said. It rained hard. And that started a chain reaction that caused an explosion. It was like the eruption of a mud volcano. Thousands were evacuated. Every pregnant woman was given an abortion. There was no choice involved. The Russian equivalent of a turnpike in the Kishtym area was closed for almost a year. Then, when word started to leak out that a very bad accident had happened on the edge of Siberia, the Russians opened the road again. But they put up some really hilarious signs. I've seen the photos. I don't read Russian, but I've asked four or five different people for a translation, and they all agree. It sounds like a bad ethnic joke. Imagine yourself driving along an American thruway, I-95 or I-70 maybe, and coming up on a sign that says, "Please close all windows, turn off all ventilation accessories, and drive as fast as your car will go for the next 20 miles. Bullshit, Ted the power man said loudly. "Photographs available under the Freedom of Information Act," Guard said. If this guy was only lying, maybe I could live with it. But he and the rest of the people like him are doing something worse. They're like salesmen telling the public that cigarettes not only don't cause lung cancer, they're full of vitamin C and keep you from having colds. Are you implying 32 at Chernobyl we can verify? Hell, maybe it is only 32. We've got photos taken by American doctors which suggest there must be well over 200 already. But say 32. It doesn't change what we've learned about high rad exposure. The deaths don't all come at once. That's what's so deceiving. The deaths come in three waves. First, the people who get fried in the accident. Second, the leukemia victims, mostly kids. Third, the most lethal wave, cancer in adults 40 and over. So much cancer, you might as well go on and call it a plague. Skin cancer, breast cancer, liver cancer, melanoma, and bone cancer are the most common. But you also get your intestinal cancer, your bladder cancer, your brain tumors, your... Stop! Can't you please stop? Ted's wife cried. Hysteria lent her voice a surprising power. I would if I could, dear, he said gently. I can't. In 1964, the AEC commissioned a study on a worst-case scenario if an American reactor one-fifth the size of Chernobyl blew. The results were so scary, the AEC buried the report. It suggested, "Shut up, Gardiner," Patty said loudly. "You're drunk." He ignored her, fixing his eyes on the power man's wife. It suggested that such an accident in a relatively rural area of the USA, the one they picked was mid-state Pennsylvania, where Three Mile Island is, by the way, would kill 45,000 folks, rad 70% of the state, and do $17 million worth of damage. Holy fuck, someone cried. Are you shitting? Nope, Gardner said, never taking his eyes from the woman, who now seemed hypnotized with terror. If you multiply by five, you get 225,000 dead and $85 million worth of damage. He refilled his glass nonchalantly in the silent grave of the room, tipped it at Arberg, and drank two mouthfuls of straight vodka. Uncontaminated vodka, one hoped. So, he finished, we're talking almost 250,000 people dead by the time the third wave dissipates around 2040. He winked at Ted, the power man, whose lips had pulled back from his teeth. Be hard to get that many people, even on a 767, wouldn't it? Those figures came directly out of your butt, Ted the power man said angrily. Ted, the man's wife said nervously. She had gone dead pale, except for tiny spots of red burning high up on her cheekbones. You expect me to stand here and listen to that party line rhetoric? He asked, approaching Gardner until they were almost chest to chest. Do you? At Chernobyl, they killed the kids, Gardner said. Don't you understand that? The ones 10 years old, the ones in utero. Most may still be alive, but they are dying right now while we stand here with our drinks in our hands. Some can't even read yet. Most will never kiss a girl in passion. Right now, while we're standing here with our drinks in our hands. They killed their children. He looked at Ted's wife, and now his voice began to shake and to rise slightly, as if in a plea. We know from Hiroshima, Nagasaki, from our own tests at Trinity and on Bikini. They killed their own children. Do you dig what I'm saying? There are 9-year-olds in Pripyat who are going to die shitting out their own intestines. They killed the children. Ted's wife took a step back, eyes wide behind her glasses, mouth twitching. We'll acknowledge that Mr. Gardner is a fine poet, I think, Ted the power man said, putting an arm around his wife and pulling her to his side again. It was like watching a cowboy rope a calf. He's not very well informed about nuclear power, however. We really have no idea what may or may not have happened at Kishtim, and the Russian figures on the Chernobyl casualties are cut the shit, Gardner said. You know what I'm talking about. Bay State Electric has got all this stuff in its files, along with the elevated cancer rates in the area surrounding American nuclear power facilities, the water contaminated by nuclear waste, the water in deep aquifers, the water people wash their clothes and their dishes and themselves in, the water they drink. You know! You and every other private, municipal, state, and federal power company in America. Stop it, Gardner, McArdle warned, stepping forward. She flashed an overbrilliant smile around the group. He's a little... Ted, did you know? Ted's wife asked suddenly. Sure, I've got some stats, but... He broke off. His jaw snapped shut so hard you could almost hear it. It wasn't much, but it was enough. Suddenly they knew, all of them, that he had omitted a good deal of scripture from his sermon. Gardner felt a moment of sour, unexpected triumph. There was a moment of awkward silence. And then, quite deliberately, Ted's wife stepped away from him. He flushed. To guard, he looked like a man who has just wanged his thumb with a hammer. Oh, we have all kinds of reports, he said. Most are nothing but a tissue of lies, Russian propaganda. People like this idiot are more than happy to swallow it hook, line, and sinker. For all we know, Chernobyl may have been no accident at all, but an effort to keep us from... Jesus. Next you'll be telling us the Earth is flat, Gardner said. Did you see the photographs of the Army guys in radiation suits walking around a power plant half an hour's drive from Harrisburg? Do you know how they tried to plug one of the leaks there? They stuffed a basketball wrapped with friction tape into a busted waste pipe. It worked for a while, then the pressure spit it out and busted a hole right through the containment wall. You spout some pretty goddamn good propaganda, Ted grinned savagely. The Russians love people like you. Do they pay you, or do you do it for free? Who sounds like an airport Mooney now? Gardner asked, laughing a little. He took a step closer to Ted. Nuclear reactors are better built than Jane Fonda, right? As far as I'm concerned, that's about the size of it, yes. Please, the dean's wife said, distressed. We may discuss, but let's not shout, please. After all, we're college people. Somebody better fucking shout about it, Gardner shouted. She recoiled, blinking, and her husband stared at Gardner with eyes as bright as chips of ice, stared as if he were marking guard forever. Guard supposed he was. Would you shout if your house was on fire and you were the only one in your family to wake up in the middle of the night and realize what was happening? Or just kind of tiptoe around and whisper on account of you're a college person? I just believe this has gone far and... Gardner dismissed her, turned to Mr. Bay State Electric, and winked at him confidentially. Tell me, Ted, how close is your house located to this nifty new nuclear facility you guys are building? I don't have to stand here at not too close, huh? That's what I thought. He looked at Mrs. Ted. She shrank away from him, clutching at her husband's arm. Gard thought, what is it that she sees to make her shrink away from me like that? What exactly? The voice of the booger-hooking comic book-reading deputy clanged back in dolorous answer. Shot your wife, huh? Good fucking deal. Are you planning to have children? He asked her gently. If so, I would hope for your sake that you and your husband really are located a safe distance from the plant. They keep goofing, you know? Like at Three Mile Island. Not long before they opened the sucker, someone discovered the plumbers had somehow hooked up a 3,000-gallon tank for liquid radioactive waste to the drinking fountains instead of the scuts. In fact, they found out about a week before the place went online. You like it? She was crying. She was crying, but he couldn't stop. The guys investigating wrote in their report that hooking up radioactive waste coolant pipes to the ones feeding water to the drinking fountains was a generally inadvisable practice. If your hubby here invites you to take the company tour, I do the same thing they tell you to do in Mexico. Don't drink the water. And if your hubby invites you after you're pregnant, or after you even think you might be, tell him, Gardner smiled, first at her, then at Ted, tell him you've got a headache, he said. Shut up, Ted said. His wife had begun to moan. That's right, Arberg said. I really don't think it's time for you to shut up, Mr. Gardner. Gard looked at them, then at the rest of the partygoers, who were staring at the tableau by the buffet, wide-eyed and silent, the young bartender among them. Shut up, Gardner yelled. Pain drove a gleaming spike into the left side of his head. Yeah! Shut up and let the goddamn house burn! You can bet these fucking slumlords will be around to collect the fire insurance later on. After the ashes cool, and they rake out what's left of the bodies. Shut up! That's what all these guys want us to do. And if you don't shut up on your own, maybe you get shut up, like Karen Silkwood. Quit it, Gardner, Patricia McCardle hissed. There were no sibilants in the words she spoke, making a hiss an impossibility, but she hissed just the same. He bent toward Ted's wife, whose sallow cheeks were now wet with tears. Also, you might check the IDS rates, infant death syndrome, that is. They go up in plant areas, birth defects such as Down syndrome, mongoloidism, in other words, and blindness, and... I want you to get out of my house, Arberg said. You got potato chips on your chin, Gardner said, and turned back to Mr. and Mrs. Bay State Electric. His voice was coming from deeper and deeper inside him. It was like listening to a voice coming out of a well, everything going critical, red lines showing up all over the control panel. Ted here can lie about how vastly overrated it all was, nothing but a little fire and a lot of headline fodder, and all of you can even believe him, but the fact is... What happened at Chernobyl nuclear plant released more radioactive waste into the atmosphere of this planet than all the A-bombs set off above ground since Trinity. Chernobyl's hot. It's going to stay that way for a long time. How long? No one really knows. Do they, Ted? He tipped his glass toward Ted and then looked around at the partygoers, all of them now standing silent and watching him. Many looking just as dismayed as Mrs. Ted. And it'll happen again. Maybe in Washington State. They were storing core rods in unlined ditches at the Hanford reactors, just like they were at Kishtim. California, the next time there's a big quake. France, Poland. Or maybe right here in Massachusetts, if this fella here has his way and the Iroquois plant goes online in the spring. Just let one guy pull the wrong switch at the wrong time, and the next time the Red Sox open at Fenway will be around 2075. Patricia McCardle was as white as a wax candle. except for her eyes, which were spitting blue sparks that looked freshly dropped from an arc welder. Arberg had gone the other route. He was as red and dark as the bricks of his fine old family Back Bay home. Mrs. Ted was looking from Gardner to her husband and back again, as if they were a pair of dogs that might bite. Ted saw the look, felt her trying to back out of his encircling, imprisoning arm. Gardner supposed it was her reaction to what he had been saying which provoked the final escalation. Ted had doubtless been instructed about how to handle hysterics like Gardner. The company taught their Teds to do that as routinely as the airlines taught stewardesses how to demonstrate the emergency oxygen system of the jets in which they flew. But it was late. Gardner's drunken but eloquent rebuttal had blown up like a pocket thunderstorm, and now his wife was acting as though he might be the butcher of Riga. "God, I get tired of you guys and your simpering. There you were tonight, reading your incoherent poems into a microphone that runs on electricity, having your braying voice amplified by speakers that run on electricity, using electric lights to see by. Where do you Luddites think that power comes from? The Wizard of Oz? Jesus!" "It's late," McCardle said hurriedly. "And we all..."
"Leukemia," Gardner said, speaking directly to Ted's wide-eyed wife with dreadful confidentiality. "The children. The children are always the ones to go first after a meltdown. One good thing, if we lose Iroquois, it'll keep the Jimmy Fund busy."
"Ted," she whimpered, "he's wrong, isn't he? I mean..."
She was fumbling for a handkerchief or a tissue in her purse and dropped it. There was the brittle sound of something breaking inside.
"Stop it," Ted said to Gardner. "We'll talk about it if you want, but stop deliberately upsetting my wife."
"I want her to be upset," Gardner said. He had embraced the darkness completely now. He belonged to it, and it belonged to him, and that was just fine.
"There's so much she doesn't seem to know, stuff she ought to know, considering who she's married to and all."
He turned the beautiful, wild grin on her. She looked into it without flinching this time, mesmerized like a doe in a pair of oncoming headlights.
"Used core rods now. Do you know where they go when they're no more good in the pile? Did he tell you that the core rod fairy takes them?"
"Not true. The power folks sort of squirrel them away. There are great big hot piles of core rods, here, there, and everywhere, sitting in nasty pools of shallow water. They're really hot, ma'am, and they're going to stay that way for a long time."
"Gardner, I want you out,"
Arberg said again. Ignoring him, Gardner went on, speaking to Mrs. Ted and Mrs. Ted only. "They're already losing track of some of those piles of used rods. Did you know that? Like little kids who play all day and go to bed tired and wake up the next day and can't remember where they left their toys. And then there's the stuff that just goes poof. The ultimate mad bomber stuff. Enough plutonium has already disappeared to blow up the eastern seaboard of the United States. But I've got to have a mic to read my incoherent poems into. God forbid I should have to raise my voice."
Arberg grabbed him suddenly.
The man was big and flabby, but quite powerful. Gardner's shirt pulled out of his pants. His glass tumbled out of his fingers and shattered on the floor. In a rolling, carrying voice, a voice which maybe only an indignant teacher who has spent many years in lecture halls could muster, Arberg announced to everyone present,
"I'm throwing this bum out."
This declaration was greeted by spontaneous applause. Not everyone in the room applauded. Maybe not even half of them did. But the power guy's wife was crying hard now, pressing against her husband, no longer trying to get away. Until Arberg grabbed him, Gardner had been hulking over her, seeming to menace her. Gardner felt his feet skim over the floor, then leave it entirely. He caught a glimpse of Patricia McCardle, her mouth compressed, her eyes glaring, her hands smacking together in the furious approval she had refused to accord him earlier. He saw Ron Cummings standing in the library door, a monstrous drink in one hand, his arm around a pretty blonde girl, his hand pressed firmly against the side swell of her breast. Cummings looked concerned, but not exactly surprised. After all, it was only the argument in the Stone Country Bar and Grill continued to another night, wasn't it? Are you going to let this swollen bag of shit just put you out on the doorstep like a stray cat?
Gardner decided he wasn't. He drove his left elbow backward as hard as he could. It slammed into Arberg's chest.
Gardner thought that was what it would feel like to drive your elbow into a bowl of extremely firm jello.
Arberg uttered a strangled cry and let go of Gardner, who turned, hands doubling into fists, ready to punch Arberg if Arberg tried to grab him again, tried to so much as touch him again. He rather hoped Argle Bargle wanted to fight. But the beefy son of a whore showed no signs of wanting to fight. He had also lost interest in putting Gardner out. He was clutching his chest like a hammy actor preparing to sing a bad aria. Most of the brick-like color had left his face, although flaring strips stood out on each cheek. Arberg's thick lips flexed into an O, slacked, flexed into an O again, slacked again.
"Heart," he wheezed.
"What heart?" Gardner asked. "You mean you have one?"
"Attack," Arberg wheezed.
"Heart attack bullshit," Gardner said. "The only thing getting attacked is your sense of propriety, and you deserve it, you son of a bitch."
He brushed past Arberg, still standing frozen in his about-to-sing pose, both hands clutched to the left side of his chest, where Gardner had connected with his elbow. The door between the dining room and the hallway had been crowded with people. They stepped back, hurriedly, as Gardner strode toward them and past them, heading for the front door. From behind him, a woman screamed, "Get out! Do you hear me? Get out, you bastard! Get out of here! I never want to see you again!" This shrewish, hysterical voice was so unlike Patricia McCardle's usual purr, steel claws buried somewhere inside pads of velvet, that Gardner stopped. He turned around and was rocked by an eye-watering roundhouse slap. Her face was ill with rage.
"I should have known better," she breathed. "You're nothing but a worthless, drunken lout, a contentious, obsessive, bullying, ugly human being. But I'll fix you. I'll do it. You know I can."
"Why, Patty, I didn't know you cared," he said.
"How sweet of you.
I've been waiting to be fixed by you for years. Shall we go upstairs or give everyone a treat and do it on the rug?"
Ron Cummings, who had moved closer to the action, laughed. Patricia McCardle bared her teeth. Her hand flickered out again, this time connecting with Gardner's ear. She spoke in a voice which was low but perfectly audible to everyone in the room.
"I shouldn't have expected anything better from a man who would shoot his own wife."
Gardner looked around, saw Ron, and said, "Excuse me, would you?" and plucked the drink from Ron's hand. In a single, quick, smooth gesture, he hooked two fingers into the bodice of McCardle's little black dress, it was elastic and pulled out easily, and dumped the whiskey inside.
"Cheers, dear," he said, and turned for the door.
It was, he decided, the best exit line he could hope to manage under the circumstances. Arberg was still frozen, with his fists clutched to his chest, mouth flexing into an O and then relaxing.
"Heart,"
he wheezed again to Gardner. Gardner, or anyone who would listen to him. In the other room, Patricia McCardle was shrieking,
"I'm all right! Don't touch me! Leave me alone! I'm all right!"
"Hey, you!"
Gardner turned toward the voice, and Ted's fist struck him high on one cheek. Gardner stumbled most of the way down the hall, clawing at the wall for balance. He struck the umbrella stand, knocked it over, and hit the front door hard enough to make the glass in the fanlight shiver. Ted was walking down the hall toward him like a gunfighter.
"My wife's in the bathroom having hysterics because of you, and if you don't get out of here right now, I'm going to beat you, Sully."
The blackness exploded like a rotted, gas-filled pocket of guts. Gardner seized one of the umbrellas. It was long, furled, and black, an English lord's umbrella, if there had ever been one. He ran toward Ted. Toward this fellow, who knew exactly what the stakes were, but who was going ahead anyway. Why not? There were 7 payments left on the Datsun Z, and 18 on the house, so why not, right? Ted, who saw a 600% increase in leukemia merely as a fact which might upset his wife. Ted, good old Ted. And it was just lucky for good old Ted that it had been umbrellas instead of hunting rifles at the end of the hall. Ted stood looking at Gardner, eyes widening, jaw dropping. The look of flushed anger gave way to uncertainty and fear, the fear that comes when you decide you're dealing with an irrational being.
Hey, caramba, you asshole!
Gardner screamed. He waggled the umbrella and then poked Ted, the power man, in the belly with it.
Hey! Ted gasped, doubling over. Stop it! Andale, andale!
Gardner yelled, now beginning to whack Ted with the umbrella, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The strap which held the umbrella furled against its handle came loose. The umbrella, still closed but now loose, slopped around the handle.
Arriba, arriba!
Ted was now too unnerved to think about renewing his attack or to think about anything but escape. He turned and ran. Gardner chased him, cackling, beating the back of his head and the nape of his neck with the umbrella. He was laughing, but nothing was funny. His earlier sense of victory was leaving fast. What victory was there in getting the best of a man like this in an argument, even temporarily, or of making his wife cry, or of beating him with a closed umbrella? Would any of those things keep the Iroquois plant from going online next May? Would any of those things save what was left of his own miserable life, or kill those tapeworms inside him that kept digging and munching and growing, eating whatever was left inside that was sane? No, of course not. But for now, senseless forward motion was all that mattered, because that was all there was left.
Arriba, you bastard, he cried,
chasing Ted into the dining room. Ted had his hands up to his head and was waving them about his ears. He looked like a man beset by bats. The umbrella did look a little bat-like as it lashed up and down.
Help me, Ted squealed. Help me, the man's gone crazy.
But they were all backing away, eyes wide and scared. Ted's hips struck one corner of the buffet. The table rocked forward and upward, silverware sliding down the inclined plane of the wrinkling tablecloth, plates falling and shattering on the floor. Arberg's Waterford punch bowl detonated like a bomb, and a woman screamed. The table tottered for a moment, then went over.
Help! 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 Andale!
Gardner brought the umbrella down on Ted's head in a particularly hard swipe. Its trigger engaged, and the umbrella popped open with a hollow push. Now Gardner looked like a mad Mary Poppins, chasing Ted the Power Man with an umbrella in one hand. Later it would occur to him that opening an umbrella in the house was supposed to be bad luck. Hands grabbed him from behind. He whirled, expecting that Arberg was over his impropriety attack and was back to have another go at giving him the bum's rush. It wasn't Arberg, it was Ron. He still seemed calm, but there was something in his face, something dreadful. Was it compassion? Yes, Gardner saw. That was what it was. Suddenly, he didn't want the umbrella anymore. He threw it aside. The dining room was silent, but for Gardner's rapid breathing and Ted's harsh, sobbing gasps. The overturned buffet table lay in a puddle of linen, broken crockery, shattered crystal. The odor of spilled rum punch rose in an eye-watering fog.
Patricia McCardle is on the telephone talking to the cops, Ron said. And when it's Back Bay, they show up in a hurry. You want to bug out of here, Jim?
Gardner looked around and saw knots of partygoers standing against the walls and in the doorways, looking at him with those wide, frightened eyes.
By tomorrow they won't remember if it was about nuclear power or William Carlos Williams, or how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, he thought. Half of them will tell the other half I made a pass at his wife. Just that good old fun-loving wife shooting Jim Gardner, going crazy and beating the shit out of a guy with an umbrella. Also dumping about a pint of Chivas between the teeny tits of the woman who gave him a job when he had none. Nuclear power. What did that have to do with it?
What a Christless mess, he said hoarsely to Ron.
Shit, they'll talk about it for years, Ron said. Best reading they ever heard, followed by the best party blow-off they ever saw. Now get going. Get your ass up to Maine. I'll call.
Ted the Power Man, eyes wide and teary, made a lunge for him. Two young men, one was the bartender, held him back.
Goodbye, Gardner said to the huddled knots of people. Thank you for a lovely time.
He went to the door, then turned back.
And if you forget everything else, remember about the leukemia and the children. Remember.
But what they'd remember was him whacking Ted with the umbrella. He saw it in their faces.
Gardner nodded and went down the hallway past Arberg, who was still standing with his hands clutched to his chest, lips flexing and closing.
Gardner did not look back. He kicked aside the litter of umbrellas, opened the door, and stepped out into the night. He wanted a drink more than he ever had in his life, and he supposed he must have found one, because that was when he fell into the belly of the big fish, and the blackout swallowed him.